This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When searching for the origins of life on Earth, you're going to need a few basic things in your toolbox. One is patience. Another is an understanding of the chemical makeup of life.
On the early Earth, there was no oxygen. And in fact, there wasn't probably any free oxygen for a very long time.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series returns with a look at the chemical makeup of Earth and how it compares to the Earth of a few billion years ago. We'll also spend an academic minute with the really nasty chemistry that goes on in the box jellyfish near the Hawaiian Islands. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The chemistry of the Earth today is nothing like it was billions of years ago. But it's that chemistry and its evolution that gives us some of the best clues to the origin of life on our planet. The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina recently spoke with Dr. Pauline Schwartz, a full professor in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering in the Tagliatella College of Engineering at the University of New Haven, about her work and how she became interested in chemistry in the first place.
I think there's probably two answers to that, and that was my educational experience. In junior high and high school, I had excellent science teachers, and I always enjoyed a very unusual program on television called Watch Mr. Wizard.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, it was fascinating. So I was always fascinated by science, and of all areas of science, chemistry just fascinated me the most. The idea that you could bring molecules together and make new molecules. And then as I began to pursue more of that, I have a PhD in medicinal chemistry, the idea of bringing together and making new compounds that might be useful as drugs and to understand why they worked, that really got me involved a lot, obviously, in chemistry. But there's many aspects of chemistry that are just really fascinating.
And is it you sort of a basic understanding that the whole world is connected through chemistry?
Well, I would like to say that that's exactly how I think. In fact, this origins of life seminars and the like certainly bring together this theme. You can start thinking about not just life as being biological, but what is the origins of that? And that is this idea of chemical evolution. What were the molecules that were running around here on the early Earth that came together and became more complex and connected that made those molecules that then somehow got together and formed those first cells, which, again, we can just begin to think of as complex chemical systems.
And what are we finding?
Well, I think there's so much excellent research going on. Certainly RPI is one of the hallmarks as a NASA Astrobiology Institute. They're doing excellent research in this area, and there's so many different facets of it. And I'm just working in one little piece of this that has to do with the structure of the molecules that are important for making the building blocks of the materials, the larger materials called macromolecules, like proteins and DNA, and especially RNA, that probably were the precursors for the first cells on Earth.
And from that, all life springs. So can you go a little further in, more specifically, into that one area of yours and exactly what you're looking at in those structures?
The particular models that we're looking at, we are, again, computational theoretical types of chemists. And we have a number of areas that we've been exploring. One that's of particular interest is called chiral symmetry breaking.
And chiral symmetry breaking.
Yes.
Explain.
Yes, indeed. It works out that living systems today, all of us, whether it's as simple as bacteria or plants or any type of living organism here on Earth, uses proteins that are built up of 20 amino acids. And those 20 amino acids all have a particular structure. They're left-handed, or L, amino acids. But if you go into the chemistry lab and make amino acids, bake both left-handed and right-handed at the same time. It's L and D, or what we call L and D. And you make them at the same time, but somehow life only uses one form, only uses the L amino acids. And it's a puzzle that we still haven't answered. And part of the research that I'm doing is maybe starting to provide some clues to what that answer might be.
What's your hypothesis?
Well, we think from our chemical models that randomly, and it happened to be L, of a particular amino acid may have formed. And we think that other research suggests that that may have been the template for other amino acids. And then we got a cascade of events from that initial time to make all the other L amino acids. And then they became the building blocks for proteins and the like. But the L amino acids were also catalytic to making the D, the other form, of the sugars. And so now we had life that depended on this idea of what they call homochirality. And there are people who believe, and I must say I agree with them, that probably all life, whether it's on Earth or wherever we find it, will really have to have this kind of homochirality of their building blocks. And so this notion of breaking symmetry, breaking left and right-handed to only one form, is probably going to be what they call a signature of life.
Interesting. So let me ask you this and follow up, because what we're talking about is prebiotic chemical systems. So if we're talking about the soup that existed before, let's say, our notions of human life and others were on the planet, where did those amino acids, where did those proteins, how did they get in that soup? Is it something that occurred in the processes on Earth? Did it come from outer space? You know, where do we fall there?
Well, I don't know that we have a direct answer, or certainly not a final answer. Maybe we'll never have a final answer, but we'll have some suggestions. And certainly we know some of the possible precursors, the really small molecules like carbon dioxide and methane and water, of course, a very important molecule. And we know that we can go into the lab and generate systems where we can make, in a rather short period of time, much more complex molecules, bigger, that would have been precursors of purines and pyrimidines and amino acids and the like. We also know, of course, that when we've seen meteorites come to Earth, they have these ingredients as well.
Yeah.
And so they could have, again, sort of seasoned the soup, as you will. And it seems like once we have some little imbalance there in that soup, that that might have been amplified in such ways that we would have then had the right chemistries to make one form, one chiral form, one-handed form of the amino acids then that made functioning macromolecules.
How much does oxygen play in all this?
You know, that's a very interesting question, because I think a lot of people, especially here on Earth today, know that we really need oxygen for most living systems. But in fact, on the early Earth, there was no oxygen. And in fact, there wasn't probably any free oxygen for a very long time. Probably the first time we saw oxygen was maybe billions of years into the lifetime of our Earth, when the first types of living systems, called cyanobacteria, made oxygen as a byproduct. And even then, that first oxygen probably got tied up in chemical reactions with iron and made all the rust that is rusting out our planet. And it was probably another time period before, again, living systems began to use other types of molecules and put out oxygen as a byproduct. And it was a long time before we saw oxygen as a free molecule on this planet. And then there are people who believe, and it might be interesting, that when we see oxygen on other planets that might have the right temperatures, and might have water, and if they have oxygen, people begin to puzzle, is that a signature that there might be life?
And I can't not bring this into the discussion, which is we're talking about the age and how long these processes have occurred, and we are just been witness to scientists looking at the Planck Observer.
Yes.
And we're finding that this background radiation is now older, 13.8 billion years old, I believe is what I read.
That's right.
How are you folks who are looking in these areas so long ago adjusting to that? Or does this lend further credence to what you're talking about? Does it jostle up some of the theories? How does this work in terms of the time period and what we're learning?
Well, if you look at some of the wonderful, wonderful pictures that have come not only just from Planck, but prior to that from WMAP, look at those beautiful pictures. You see little colors that obviously are meant to show you different temperatures. And what you begin to see is it's not homogeneous. We've broken symmetry and we see differences in temperatures. Now, they're very small differences in temperatures, but those differences then became amplified, and they became our galaxies. And so this notion of breaking symmetry is certainly not something we're just seeing here as a chemical basis for life on Earth. It may be part of something that's really important to our entire universe, this notion that so many other features are, if you will, broken symmetries. The fact that we have more matter than antimatter, the fact that we have galaxies and the like. There may be a big theme that we need to explore in this notion of chiral symmetry breaking.
And is it, if I'm understanding this correctly, Dr. Schwartz, that this diversity that we're finding, let's say, in the universe, not only in the universe, but on the planet of Earth as well, lends to the idea that it's more likely that life is abundant?
I think that's, to be honest, my own personal thought is that's probably true, that life is probably going to be found elsewhere. We might be able to scratch up on the surface of Mars, and maybe we'll find more than just chemical evidence. Maybe we'll find some other evidence there.
And for those of the who are, haven't been paying attention, it looks like Curiosity has found some basic evidence, yes?
The chemical ingredients
are
there.
Right.
But again, we know that bacteria and the like don't leave fossils. And so we'll have to look for other types of evidence if, in fact, something started there. But I think at least life on Earth, we know and we have a rather good theory and solid evidence that suggests that all life on Earth did indeed start from a single origin. And if we begin to think about that, that we are all related, not just all humans, which of course is true, but all life, maybe that'll certainly change how we begin to look at our future.
Still to come, David Gustina's conversation with Dr. Pauline Schwartz continues with a look at the future. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1196. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Pauline Schwartz, a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering in the Tagliatella College of Engineering at the University of New Haven. She's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina about her work in chemistry and how it relates to the origins of life on Earth. We'll pick up their conversation as David asks Dr. Schwartz about technology and the future.
You know, as we see this exponential growth of technology, where even in searching for stars or comets or asteroids, we've got the general public involved now. How has the technology and your modeling, let's say, with your students and yourself, how has that moved things forward? Has it sped up, much like the technology itself, in terms of research?
Well, I think for us, again, because we are computational chemists, having even something as simple as a desktop computer has been enormously valuable for us. We could not have done the research that we've done without those kinds of tools. And so, you know, there's lots of things that go in it. And you can imagine that future tools may give you hints and clues to other things that we haven't explored yet that may, in fact, lead to even better ideas.
Well, speaking of ideas, you said that your students have been uncovering unusual, quote, unusual things. And before that, you mentioned theoretical chemistry and computational chemistry. And, you know, the subject of math in general is not one of my strong suits, Dr. Schwartz. I'll leave that to you. But talk a little bit more about some of these things that you're doing with your students. And what are these unusual things?
Well, one of these unusual things that we uncovered, and again, as I said, we're lucky when we're doing computational chemistry, we can do it anytime, anywhere. My students often come in the morning saying, oh, look at what I found overnight. And so that's a lot of fun. Something that they don't need a lab. All they need essentially is a computer, much like a mathematician only needs a pad and pencil. Well, we need computers, but it just lends us to looking at some unusual things. And what we've found is this idea of, as I mentioned earlier, breaking symmetry called a bifurcation. And this is something we could explore, not only with computers, because you just don't want to use a computer as a black box, put in information and accept it without thinking more about it. Again, as I mentioned, Dr. Carl Barrett, who's our math wizard, has begun to help us analyze our data and make sure that what we do, if you will, longhand, is consistent with what the computer is telling us, that we're not doing something that is just, you know, believe the computer, accept the input and the output without further analysis. But in fact, it's been quite rewarding that our mathematical analysis has been consistent with what the computer models are showing us. And this notion that we are finding what is consistent with our theory about how symmetry may have broken at least one possible chemical system where that may have occurred. Now, we're looking at some other systems of chemistry. Systems chemistry is the sort of area that we're into. And it's just been a very rewarding area that we, you know, begin to think and read and explore some ideas and bring in some math and bring in some paradoxes that are unusual and then try to make some interesting chemistry. And again, much of that has been applicable to prebiotic chemistry.
What's a paradox? I don't mean the definition of the term, but what have you found that's a paradox in your research?
Well, the first paradox we explored was something called Pirondo's paradox.
Pirondo's paradox.
Yeah, it's not very well known, but it's rather interesting. And again, totally mathematical. And what it said is if you take two types of games, no, these aren't really casino-type games, so don't go running off. But if you take those games and played them individually, call it game A and game B, you would, if you were playing it with money, for example, you'd lose. But if you played game A, then B, then A, then B, back and forth like that, you'd win. Now, yeah, you've given me that look. That's a paradox. And if you explored the math and really, really explored the math, you'd say, oh, yeah, now I get it. It's not so paradoxical. There it is. It's really hidden in the math. But what we started with was to take that mathematical paradox and ask, could we do that with chemistry? And so what we did is we looked at a chemical system and we explored differences in temperature and asked, could we go from temperature 1 to temperature 2 and temperature 1, back and forth? You'd never do this in the lab. It's not a real world sort of thing, but it's a perfectly good thing for a model system. And there we saw unusual sorts of things happening, this idea of just unusual behavior because chemical systems are nonlinear.
Sure. And as much as in life is nonlinear, right?
That's correct.
And, you know, one of the things that struck me when you were talking about this is the fact that you have your students there and they are actually involved in something very pragmatic. That one of the problems in teaching sometimes is we're working out of a textbook or we're mm-hmm. working on theories and we don't get to test those things. I don't think you have that problem, do you?
No, we don't have that problem with, again, the small group of students we have. But the idea that students get involved in something, you're right, outside the box, outside the standard textbook and tests and, you know, here's a deadline for a particular paper. When they begin to explore research, things open up that are very, very different. Now, research doesn't always work. Sometimes it can be very, very frustrating and very difficult for young investigators. They might try very, very hard and work very hard and find nothing. Either their initial hypothesis is not correct or they don't have the right tools and resources to explore it properly. And so we've been lucky that we've been able to find something that really has resulted in some publications and, again, even in some of the talks that we're giving. But this is very valuable to students because, again, even if they're not going to be working on this particular area, they get involved in research. They begin to realize that that's the contribution that they're making to explore human knowledge and add to it.
Two more questions for you. We're talking, of course, with Dr. Pauline Schwartz. And I wanted to ask you about this medicinal chemistry.
I can tell you a little bit more by virtue of the fact that I teach a course in medicinal chemistry. I teach a course in pharmacology, mainly to graduate students and to upper level undergraduates. They're mainly interested in going on further in their careers, either in grad school or interested in careers in the pharmaceutical areas. Some are interested in medical schools and the like. My area of research some time ago had been in asking how do certain drugs work. And I was interested in rather traditional drugs, drugs that are usually used for cancer or also used for certain types of diseases called hyperproliferative diseases. And that can occur in the skin. Things like psoriasis is an example mm-hmm. of that. And these drugs are used not only then for treating cancer, but also in that area. And I was interested in how they worked And could we make them work better? Could we make them in different combinations work better? And so that was the type of research I was doing in exploring mechanisms and metabolism of those kinds of drugs before joining UNH full-time.
You said before, it's hidden in the math when we're talking about the paradox. I wonder if philosophically you believe that our understanding, as it seems to continue to grow, of the origin of life, not only on this planet, but what's happening in the greater universe that we're surrounded by. Do you think the answer might be hidden in that math?
Could very well be. There's a wonderful new book called What is Life? As Chemistry Becomes Biology. That's a fellow by the name of Adi Prose. And so he's saying biology is just chemistry. Well, I think the physicists would come along and say, hey, chemistry is just physics. And the mathematicians, of course, are going to win. They're going to say, hey, it's all math.
Dr. Pauline Schwartz is a full professor in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering in the Tagliatella College of Engineering at the University of New Haven. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series at origins.rpi.edu. Well, while we're on the subject of chemistry, there is some really nasty chemistry going on inside the box jellyfish. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The sea is full of large and dangerous creatures, but one of the most deadly is surprisingly small and almost impossible to see. Angel Yanagihara, assistant researcher and director of the Pacific Cnidaria Research Lab at the University of Hawaii, reveals new insights into the venom of the deadly box jellyfish.
Chironex fluceri, the Australian box jelly, is the most deadly venomous animal on the planet, causing death in minutes. How could a simple jellyfish be more deadly than a rattlesnake or cobra? I began studying box jelly venoms 14 years ago after plowing into a swarm of transparent, related but non-lethal Hawaiian box jellies during an early morning swim. I suffered horribly painful stings over much of my exposed skin, including my neck. The fiery pain and days-long agony got my full attention. As a biochemist, I was completely intrigued, but as a sting victim, it was personal. I wanted to know more. I developed new methods to recover the venom, which doesn't come from a gland as in a spider or snake, but is packaged in millions of individual stinging cells along the tentacles, each with just a few picoliters of venom. I used old-fashioned basic biochemistry to identify the principal components. Remarkably, the fastest-acting agent is a porin, a member of an even older family of toxic proteins and structurally related to the proteins that drive toxicity of many pathogenic bacteria. This porin alone could cause death in seconds in a mouse, far faster than any snake toxin ever discovered. In reviewing the bacteriological literature, I found that almost 100 years ago, various ions had been shown to inhibit bacterial porin-driven lysis. Taking this precedent, I designed complex matrix experiments to assess the individual and combinatorial efficacy of such ions on inhibiting the porins of the box jellies. This led to the finding that zinc gluconate could prevent box jelly porin-mediated death in a mouse. Work is now rapidly proceeding to examine the application of this discovery for life-threatening human stings, as well as a topical formula for common jelly stings.
That was Angel Yanagihara of the University of Hawaii. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.